Kultur denken, der Podcast des IFK Wien. Willkommen bei Kultur denken, dem Podcast des IFK Wien. Mein Name ist Martin Gasterner. In dieser Folge spreche ich mit Ori Talpan über smarte Technologien, resiliente Infrastrukturen und die Vorstellungskraft für andere Zukünfte. Ori Talpan ist Professorin und Chair of Digital Cultures an der TU Dresden. Ihre Forschung verbindet Wissenschaftsgeschichte, Kybernetik und Design. In ihrem aktuellen Buch The Smartness Mandate – MIT Press 2023 zeigt sie, wie Smartness zur neuen Logik von Steuerung und Überleben wurde.
Would you give me an idea what resilience means to you?
For me, resilience means an idea of the world where things like shock and trauma at a personal level, but also at a social level, are accepted as the standard condition. Usually we might think a few decades ago that, for example, a major hurricane, a devastating cyclone, a devastating war, or an act of ethnic cleansing would be unusual. Today, whether it's talking about the climate crisis, we have these ideas of the new normal, right? That the Elbe is going to flood, that sea level rise is an expectation, that regular extreme climate events that cause extreme devastation to human and more than human life are pretty standard. They're to be expected. The same thing maybe with, for example, disruptive politics, whether it's Trump, Putin, Netanyahu. We've started to normalize the figure of this kind of disruptor, right, that comes in and sort of wrecks everything. The way the news cycle is operating, by now there's yet another, and these are very intense events right now. If we're talking about Ukraine or the Middle East, or many of the emerging conflicts that might be coming up with China, these are massive global level events that have in many ways come to be expected as disruptions rather than treated as a different standard state. It's almost like we've abandoned the idea that peace should be the norm and war should be the deviation. And of course, there's always been theorists and people saying that that's never been true. But let's just call it an imaginary that there would be a calm, stable world and that these sort of events, whether environmental, economic, or could also talk about the constant and regular economic crisis, 2008, COVID, inflation, and also at a personal level, right? You're expected to lose your job like 50 times. The expectation of lifelong employment, pension funds, security, these things have all disappeared. Resilience is the term that has emerged most potently since the 1970s. First, it came out of the environmental sciences, but then it increasingly became a major concept in business management, urban planning, design, technology.
I was wondering, what discipline are your origins in? Because you handle a lot of disciplines and transfer resilience to many perspectives. How do you get this all together? What is the grounding of your questions?
Well, to be honest, originally I was trained in history as an undergrad. But then I went to public health.
In what disciplines were you trained in?
I wanted to be a doctor for a while. And so I had a public health training and worked in HIV/AIDS in the US and then international development for a few years. And I started to think critically about the ways we were thinking about development. And so I came back to school to study a field called history of science, science technology studies. I came to start studying or trying to think about how do we understand at that time, this is way back, like in the early 2000s, the internet and digitalization still seemed like a pretty new and exciting thing that was transforming society. But anytime we say a technology is transforming society, we want to ask, well, is it? So what's happening with digital technology different than what was happening with electricity or with a telegraph or what have you? And so I was trying to understand how we create a history of computing that isn't just about the machine, you know, isn't just about objects, you know, not just about my cell phone, but actually recognizes the fact that the internet seemed much more than just one technology. It seemed like a way of life, a transformation in how we pay attention, changing how we experience the world as individuals, and was changing how organizations and institutions were organized, whether it's businesses or universities. It seemed like an epistemology, which is a way of knowing the world, with acting, a way of representing the world, not just a machine. Where did ideas, for example, let's take AI. If you hear the word generative adversarial network, what do you think? Well, I think Darwinian evolution. I think competitive, yeah. Adversarial. I think about fitness. When we talk about optimization, I mean, surely you're going to be thinking a history of efficiency, competition, maybe terms like fitness. So you start being like, wait, it's not just when we talk about an AI model, that model might incorporate something like a model of nature in it. And that model of nature makes us accept this new technology because, you know, nature is natural. We accept what's supposedly natural. So why wouldn't we accept an AI that seems to work on the principles of nature? That's where the connection comes, because as a historian of science, you start thinking both about the ideas that inspire the technology and the actual practices and material acts of the technology.
So where would you start then to have a history of AI? Would it start here in Vienna with Wiener Kreis, or is it Kubernetes, or is it much earlier?
You know what? I remember Zelensky back from grad school, or you could go back probably to the Stone Age. All histories are limited, and they're also about the story you want to tell about the present, right? Yeah. Ultimately, I write history for the present and for the future, actually. I want to tell stories that impact how we design, so I want to challenge certain assumptions we have about why technology works the way it does. So for me, my histories are far more limited. They tend to be grounded in the 20th century. Since I mostly come from an American history background, deeply biased in that sense, I focus on cybernetics and the emergence at post-World War II of American empire and the relation of these sciences to American empire, the Cold War, American sciences, and ultimately Silicon Valley. I would say a big obsession involves Vienna, things like the Vienna Circle, Freud, psychoanalysis, the sciences, this question of what we can calculate is fundamental to the current imaginary and arguments around AI. When my next set of projects around historicizing it, things like the socialist calculation debates and just basic questions the Vienna Circle involved themselves with, particularly about the Entscheidungsproblem and the kind of limits of calculatability, are fundamental, because there's a lot of fantasies about AI that are about being able to overcome this basic limitation of being unable to describe everything algorithmically or mathematically. I think both understanding the contests and also why people would want to understand the world this way, as well as understanding the inherences of those discussions, could be very important. And in many ways could be important also to challenge current Silicon Valley techno-optimism that ignores social questions and the reasons people would want to assert reason or rationality in the face of extremist politics, let's say, against national socialism or against rising fascism. So I think we have to really be thinking about what is reason right now, and particularly in an age of post-truth politics, how do we want to reinterpret or understand these histories of thinking about evidence and truth and what we can calculate and plan as society is really important.
You published a book last year called The Smartness Mandate. From Fordism, we always heard about the creative mandate we had in society and in every aspect of culture, but what is the smartness mandate and what does it imply?
Well, that's an excellent question. This is a book co-authored with my colleague, Robert Mitchell at Duke University. We were struck by the emergence and proliferation of this term smart, right? Smartphones, smart cars, smart everything. And of course, it's closely related to big data and artificial intelligence. I was working in urban planning, looking at design and planning, at the way smartness sort of complemented, one could see it as sort of an outgrowth of creativity, but in many ways was really a lot about survival, that people really thought you had to have smart cities to deal with climate crises. You really have to have smart traffic systems in order to reduce energy. Energy grids have to become smart grids to facilitate the transition. There seemed to be some, like, this term wasn't just something you liked or wanted to be. It was something you had to do. Everything must become smarter. Just like right now, everything has to have artificial intelligence. The two are related, but I'll talk a little bit about why they're not exactly the same term. We turned to investigating that question about why smartness suddenly emerged as so potent a language to mobilize everything from urban planning to telecom infrastructures to energy infrastructures to personal devices. And we understood that smartness was a pretty recent term and that it had been massively mobilized. There's a prehistory of smartness coming from electrical grids, where people started calling things smart grids, I believe, somewhere in the 70s and 80s. And then, of course, was introduced around telephony by IBM. But it really came to prominence exactly at the moment of the financial crisis in 2008. When the chairman of IBM sort of introduces Smart Planet. It's a really interesting moment where the movement of capital and the reorganization of computing around in the environment, basically an infrastructure. People are moving away from just providing social networks to actually like owning the, you know, the tubes under your buildings, a penetration into a whole new locus, maybe also a market, that they saw as a possible future frontier in a really colonial way for computing and for gathering data. This kind of sits because you need these infrastructures. If everything isn't smart, you can't get your big data sets. It follows that from smartness would come artificial intelligence because you need everything to be collecting data at your phone, your house, your Alexa, everything in order to have the training sets for the next installation. But we were also really interested in the other fantasies of smartness. What is smartness? It is in many ways a fantasy. It emerged out of a fantasy and in many ways linked to neoliberalism of not having to plan. So how do you get past the political issues of deciding whether to build a seawall? Hopefully data-driven decision-making will allow systems to self-organize and make the best optimal decision without having to introduce the fragmented and different issues of community-based politics in a city. It's part of a techno-managerial mandate. It's an economy and embedded in a series of ideas. A lot of what we write about is actually about financialization. You cannot think about smartness without financialization. And we use the term derivation ahead of optimization. We connect it to a financial operation, which is how do you derive more value from underlying assets by using more data to figure out how you can get additional services and functions without actually having to build new infrastructures or hire more people or what have you. So we're interested in smartness as a financial concept, as a environmental idea in terms of management, as a mode of circumventing political, formal democratic political scenes. This mandate encapsulates this merger of neoliberalism, technology, and ideas about progress in new ways.
How was the book received? Critics?
Well, yeah. So far, we have some really excellent reviews. Sometimes people want a more simple account. The account I've been giving in this podcast sounds pretty negative. But we're also really interested in positive smartness. For example, we're interested in thinking smartness beyond just artificial intelligence and big data. People think about their communities as smart in terms of thinking about human networks and relations as also being a form of intelligence that we need to account for. We also look at things like indigenous groups and smart energy grids, for example, how efforts at energy sovereignty by indigenous groups in the American West implement and think about using smart systems in different ways. We also look at how smartness has transformed our ideas of the environment, looking at people like Susan Simard and her work on smart forests and sort of the way that trees share information through mycorrhizal networks. So we try to think a lot with smartness as a problematic but also interesting category. One of the reasons we said smartness rather than artificial intelligence is that smart in English has a bunch of different implications. If something can hurt you, it can be smart. Like if you scratch yourself, it's smart. Something smart can also be like, you look smart today. And of course, it also has an implication of intelligence, but sometimes more street smart than the notions of intelligence we might see linked to AI that come from historically racist formats like the IQ that attempt to quantify and standardize human intelligence. In general, the word artificial intelligence is sort of a standardization of intelligence because it assumes there's one real intelligence and this is the artificial version. Smart has a broader connotation and also tends to be linked less to the human. When we talk about smart systems, we tend to talk about cities, telecommunication systems, energy grids, etc. When we use AI, we tend to really think about human decision making. But again, most smart systems do implement AI today in order to automate decision making, so they are closely related. Smartness tends to be understood as more environmental and infrastructural. Those are interesting relations. People's tendency is to want to see a simple story about it. They want to hear bad technology, good people. But the truth is, we are currently codependent on our technology, even as it's also a source of our suffering. It's also potentially a source for improving equity, justice, diversity, both in human and more than human systems. So we have to be thinking about new terms, new languages, and possibly ways to implement our technologies that are better than those that Elon Musk or Peter Thiel are coming up with. So that's been the debate about the book, what kind of account people want about this technology.
I didn't receive it as negative, the book, but resilience is some kind of way through this as well, because there's always a forward and backwards. You have to be always in motion, thinking-wise, and also with your corpus.
Yes, of course. Just to frame for listeners the question, one component of the book is a strong focus on the ideas of evolution in environment and nature that are incorporated into smart technologies and artificial intelligence. A key term there is resilience, which is an idea that really emerged in the 1970s. Out of ecology through the work of C.S. Holling, but also many other people. I don't want to create an originary story because, interestingly enough, almost the same year that these ideas of ecology, Milton Friedman introduces the idea of a broad-based, resilient currency options market and currencies to deal with the end of Bretton Woods and the gold standard. We see this term resilience emerge a lot. In ecology, it's important because our concepts about computing and technology are very much linked to security. The idea of making your city smart is securing it against future bad events. Most of the reasons people start saying we need smart stuff is because we're supposedly in a crisis. And of course, in Germany now, the energy transition being the number one place you'll see smart infrastructure being deployed. We need these computers to help us reduce energy, count everything, optimize our driving plans, make sure the buildings use less heating, so on and so forth, secure ourselves against negative impacts on the economy. So it's a negative vision of the future. And so this got us to be writing seriously about resilience because it seemed like a term that accepts the fact that the future is pretty bad and literally says, we can't change it. So it's not like anyone's trying to stop the climate crisis. It's like an assumed thing, it's going to happen. So now we just have to prepare. And that seems to be very, very potent, even by the best intended people when it comes to how we construct our technology. So it becomes very central to theorizing and historicizing smartness.
You mentioned Cold War. And I was thinking about Sputnik shock and on the aftermath.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And on the other hand, we do have this narration. I think it was built up by very manly history writing, atomic bomb, and how the computer is founded because of the saving, because the atomic bomb arises. Do you think these narrations still have an impact on how we perceive technology and these concepts of imaginary futures?
Yeah, of course. Two things about that. First, the Cold War clearly informs our contemporary world a lot. In the wake of the Ukraine war, there's been a reinterest because we kind of forgot the Cold War existed, and 89 was even forgotten. It was kind of like, oh, this just happened and no one's really thinking about the transition and it's all fine. But current geopolitics, China, Russia, the whole world has really opened up both what it means post-socialism and also what was the Cold War actually about. And so there's no question that issues of security and issues of both calculating the bomb as well as needing to build security systems against nuclear attack clearly informed the mentality that we come into. The idea that we could destroy ourselves with our own technology was inaugurated by the bomb. In many ways, the bomb also inaugurated another term fundamental to smartness, which is the Anthropocene. There are many Anthropocenes, of course. There's a Plantationocene, a Capitalocene. We could tell many histories, but many people say the bomb is the first time you actually see human behavior in the geological substrate and therefore marks a new relation to nature and culture, as well as, you know, our deciding our own extinction. It's not something else competing against us. It's like humanity could destroy itself. Those kind of apocalyptic negative futures clearly inform the present and are inherited. However, I would say in the 50s to the 70s to the 80s, we still had Keynesian state. So there was an idea of planning. There was an idea of redistributive justice in the Western world. I'm not going to make light of the fact that it wasn't linked to active practices in the global South. But for those of us in Western Europe and North America, and particularly United States and Canada, you know, there was a Keynesian state. There was an incredible also techno-optimism. So for all the negativity, there was also a huge amount of ideas about abundance, the good middle class life, all these other things. And I think what is concerning today, and particularly when we think about the alt-right, but even in our mentality to technology, is the kind of nihilism of the discourse. It's kind of like we lost what we had, but it doesn't present a positive future, right? Donald Trump mobilizes this white racist idea that these other groups took something from you. But outside of destroying those other groups, there's nothing being projected to replace this. It's make America great again, the again being the key term. There's a real concern about our contemporary imaginaries and the way they're creating technologies embedded in readiness to accept a negative future and a nihilistic and even survivalist vision of the world, which this new obsession with space kind of embodies. But it's not going to be space for everyone. It's going to be like three guys. So I think that that's where we have to really struggle against these discourses that accept a negative future that only technology will permit certain people who know how to command it and own it to survive.
Orit Helton, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Die Signation unseres Podcasts stammt von Sebastian Klinkowski. Wissenschaftliche Beratung erfahren wir durch Karin Harasser, Andreas Gerlach und Julia Burg-Kaminski. Für die Öffentlichkeitsarbeit zuständig ist Stefanie Obermeier. Technische Unterstützung Max Ott. In der Produktion unterstützen mich Christina Högler, Daniela Losinitzki und Andreas Katan. Die Konzeption des Kulturdenken-Podcasts stammt von Alexander Martor und mir, Martin Gasteiner. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören. Wir freuen uns auf ein Wiederhören in der nächsten Folge von Kultur Denken.